Good morning, and thanks. I woke up with a really sore throat this morning, so apologies if I sound a bit hoarse or have to drink a lot of water. It's really exciting to be part of this set of conversations, and I think there's quite a lot that what Martin has just presented and what I have to say, many ways in which the two speak to each other, so hope we can have a good discussion afterwards. I want to talk about the methodological, ethical, and political issues surrounding what I'm going to call the production of Tangmi ritual texts, in which I'm currently engaged, along with several other people. There are many issues that I could raise, but what I want to focus on in particular is the challenges that anthropologists face when we work with communities who are actively involved in the process of debating their own relationships with orality and textuality, and in which there's not necessarily a clear community consensus on how these issues should be approached, not necessarily a community perspective or the indigenous view that we can easily represent, or a single form of tradition that we can document. So I want to be a bit provocative and suggest that in such circumstances, one of the best choices or ways forward as an anthropologist may be to actually acknowledge our own roles in producing certain kinds of textual forms in a very kind of upfront way, and acknowledge how those roles may or may not bear a direct relation to the indigenous forms of practice and performance that we observe. So to get to that conclusion, let me talk you through a set of experiences that I've had over the last decade in working with the Tangmi community in Nepal. Just a little bit of background first. The Tangmi are a group of about 40,000 whose homeland area is up here in central eastern Nepal, but have a long history of circular migration back and forth to Darjeeling and Sikkim in India, and also northwards just across the border into the Tibetan autonomous region. The Tangmi speak their own Tibeto-Burman language, which Mark has documented in depth, and their religious system integrates aspects of shamanism, Hinduism, and Buddhism in a synthetic manner. This just gives you a little bit of a view. The primary religious practitioners, some of whom you see here, are called gurus. In Tangmi, that term has been indigenized as a Tangmi term. And they serve both the role of priest and shaman rolled into one. There aren't multiple practitioners representing different traditions the way we might be familiar with from Tamang or Gurung cases in particular. But rather, there are these single figures known as gurus who are cultural knowledge holders as well as primary ritual officiants. So what I want to focus on here is the primacy that orality is accorded in the worldview of Tangmi gurus and the problems that this causes for another group of Tangmi, who I'm going to call activists, for lack of a better term, who instead emphasize the need to textualize Tangmi traditions. Okay, so this just gives you some images of activists and their workplaces, so to speak. A political conference of the Nepal Tami Samaj in Kathmandu in 2005, and then the office to the Tami Welfare Association in Darjeeling. It may sound as if these are two hard and fast groups, the gurus and the activists. That's obviously not the case, but just for simplicity's sake, in this short talk, I'm going to refer to them as such. And really what these terms do is to represent worldviews at two ends of a continuum, which most Tangmi fall somewhere along. And both of these groups, gurus and activists, are present in both Nepal and India. It's not that gurus are on one side of the border, activists are on the other, but rather there are both types of people, both types of worldview in both contexts, and they're actually dealing with very different political environments within each country in terms of the way they're conceptualizing their political and pragmatic agendas in relation to overall national political processes. And what I should say, just in brief, is that in both countries, all of this, what I'm going to talk about, is unfolding against highly politicized backgrounds in which the politics of identity and culture are very emotional. In Nepal, this has to do, at the moment, with the restructuring of the state in the wake of the end of the last 10 years of Maoist state conflict. And the state is being restructured probably along ethno-linguistic lines, so claims to culture and history have the potential, it seems, to be very important in real pragmatic terms. In India, it has largely to do with tribal politics, the politics of getting recognized as a scheduled tribe or an other backwards class within India's system of reservations. Can't say too much more about that, but I'm happy to talk more in questions if people would like. So Tangmi oral tradition as practiced by gurus are embedded in a ritual form known as paloke. This might come from the Nepali term palaknu, to chant, but it's not really entirely clear to me. It's somewhat akin to the kirant mudum form, which Martin, among others, have described in detail. I, over the course of my fieldwork, got a range of definitions of what the paloke, in fact, was or were, from it is everything that gurus say, to it's the melody with which we call the deities, it's the particular way or form in which Tangmi speak. And activists who are writing about gurus' paloke in practice have also tried to pinpoint the concept. There are several activist publications in which the paloke are described as the oral history of the Tangmi, ritual language of the gurus, history of the Tangmi, and sayings of the Tangmi guru are famous oral texts. So these are the kinds of ways that people are representing this complex for themselves. I eventually gave up trying to seek a single concise definition of the term, but determined that it seemed best explained as an oral tradition encoded in a ritual register of the Tangmi language, which established the basis for a shared sense of Tangminess amongst an otherwise very heterogeneous group by pointing towards a shared set of sacred origins, which is actually embedded in the origin myths themselves, which are what is really talked about and recited in the process of the paloke. So I suggest that both gurus and activists agree that the paloke are the central repository of Tangmi identity and history, the source of Tangmi originary power or identity. And as such, both groups agree that these need to be preserved in some manner. But they differ about over how this should actually be done. Currently, for the most part, the paloke are practiced in an exclusively oral and performative form, and senior Tangmi guru often resist the proposed textualization of their paloke by activists from within their own community. Such refusals emerge out of fears that activists might misuse ritual texts for purely expedient purposes, and there's also an element of fear of writing as a tool of exploitation, which derives from the history of exploitative, basically land tenure documents in the area where Tangmi are resident in Nepal. By the same token, activists often feel that the guru's resistance to documentation of their paloke is an undemocratic effort to exert total control over cultural content that, in fact, should be the domain of all Tangmi, and that, in a way, activists pose it as anachronistic, that in this age of democracy and now secular democracy in Nepal and also India, it's not really appropriate to have a ritual tradition that it's the province of a few highly skilled people, but rather there should be a way in which everyone can have access to it by making it available in text. Gurus argue that paloke are an inherently embodied form, which must be transmitted through an integrated form of practice, in which the words themselves can't be separated from the context of ritualized action in which they're uttered. And this gets back to some of what I think Ruth was talking about yesterday and also relates back to the question of what can you actually do with an in vitro performance. The process of textualization in which the words themselves might be written down in a form which delinks them from the practice context is anathema to many gurus, and from their perspective, in fact, challenges the very existence of Tangmi identity or power. Activists, on the other hand, argue that only through textualization can the paloke be passed down to the next generation and circulated among a broader Tangmi public, but also a broader political forum in which to establish Tangmi claims to identity, perhaps even territory, and so forth. So I just wanted to read an example of a passage from one Tangmi activist in a publication which came out in 2007, a self-declared intellectual who's very heavily critical of gurus and their practice and makes a strong argument for textualization, just to give you a sense of the tensions within the community. He writes, and this is translated from Nepali, "Our Guru Appa recites spiritual mantras, which they make up, but these are not written. The same mantra is passed to his followers in oral, not written form. In order to preserve his power, the Guru never teaches his mantra to others. Since the beginning, our community's gurus have taken their mantra with them when they die. Now, how many mantras have these gurus taken with them from ancient times until the present? Since they're not written down, the modern generation is forced to suffer to obtain their various practices. Since they are done differently by each Guru Appa, it seems that their traditional practices cannot be correct. We have no way of knowing if the so-called guru, in his state of intoxication, is pronouncing his mantra correctly or not, or whether he is just making up the sentences, which he has actually forgotten. We don't have written written text to prove it. If we did have those texts, we could correct the guru, saying, here is a mistake, here you've left it unfinished. Not all gurus are like this, but some have hoarded power and tried to dominate our community. To solve these problems, the gurus, the intellectuals, and experienced members of the community should sit together and correct our practices. These must be published in a book with which gurus should train students, and just like any other pandit, monk, priest, or mulla, they should try to produce many future gurus." So this gives you a real sense of the dynamic that's going on. And the author of this passage is somebody who is very influential as the chairman of the Nepal Thami Samaj for some years, originally from Darjeeling, but resident in Kathmandu, and had a kind of power to influence the way many younger Thami thought. I mean, I see this debate as actually echoing foundational anthropological debates over the issues of text and context in the documentation of myth, going back to Malinowski, Levi-Strauss, and many others. But in this case, it's actually community members themselves who are taking these positions about the role of myth and how it should actually be reproduced, and hashing them out in public, often politicized forums. The interesting thing, really, is that both camps, in a way, need each other. They can't actually go their separate ways, because activists can't access the practice context of Paloke without gurus. Almost no activists are actually proficient in Thangmi ritual language. They don't actually have the cultural and linguistic resources to perform these things on their own. But the gurus increasingly find that the performative contexts in which their paloke are commissioned are shaped by activist agendas, such as cultural performances, conferences, and so forth, as well as resources, both financial and political, that activists control. So what is an anthropologist to do with this kind of situation? I think that historically, the default position for an anthropologist in this kind of situation might have been to assume that the gurus are in fact the bearers of authentic cultural knowledge, which is somehow endangered by a kind of processes of modernization and textualization as represented by the activists, which might have the effect of destroying authentic cultural knowledge. But what I've been trying to do, which is sometimes challenging, is to take kind of more complicated view, which recognizes the interplay between these community factions itself as productive of contemporary Thangmi culture, and sees both modes of accessing or controlling spiritual power, so both the performative and the textual, as equally authentic within the heterogeneous Thangmi whole. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about how I'm trying to do that, and the production of texts themselves. Through the engagement with these community debates over the last decade, I've come to feel that treating the Paloke as oral literature from a scholarly perspective and documenting and disseminating it as such can actually help to bridge the impasse between these community factions. Gurus who have not allowed activists from their own community to record or transcribe their Paloke have, after several years of trust building, allowed me, Mark, and an indigenous Thangmi scholar, whom you see here, who we've worked with, Bir Bahadur Thami, to make such recordings and to transcribe them and to begin the process of actually producing Thangmi ritual texts, in a sense. In a way, this is a complex balancing act between all of these different camps, but so far we seem to be largely successful in maintaining some kind of mediating position, but also creating a set of forums in which community members can actually debate these ideas with each other and then create, in a sense, a kind of third space or a perspective in which these things can actually be produced, which is a kind of scholarly space, which is not really in either activist or guru camps. So this year we actually began the process of producing a book of Tangmi ritual texts, which has three sections, focuses on wedding, funeral, and then one calendrical ritual, Devikut Katka Jatra. And it's based on recordings of the actual practice events. It's been a difficult process of choosing which recordings to actually go forward with, but the idea has been not to try to present a single authoritative version or to codify any particular guru's paloke, because there are also many differences between individual practice, but actually to choose recordings, which, dealing with some of the issues Martin was addressing, which were good recordings in themselves, but also represented a range of different kinds of guru's practice in choosing the recordings that we went with for each of these three ritual forms. And so this summer in Cambridge, we had Bir Bahadur Thami with us here and worked for 2 months along with him and a fourth collaborator, Hikmat Karka, who is a professional Nepali translator, in order to create a document in which we had the transcribed Thangmi ritual recitation first, then a Nepali translation, in order to make it accessible to most Thangmi, not all of whom speak Thangmi themselves, but who could read Nepali, and then also English in order to make it accessible to a broader community and scholarly community. So let me see if we can see what it looks like. So that's what we started working on this summer, and we've gotten through now basically the wedding or bure paloke, and have the other two sections to complete. So hopefully it will be a publication in three languages. That's the title page. And we've produced an introduction, which is in Nepali and English only, not Thangmi for various reasons, partially because it's would be a bit mostly back translating from Nepali. And then each of the 10 sections of the wedding recitations are introduced with a short kind of summary of what actually occurs in both Nepali and English. And then the recitations themselves are presented in three languages side by side. Now, this is just exported from a database. It hasn't been properly formatted yet, but it gives you a rough sense of what it would look like. So the next step in this process has actually been to present this material back to the community to show them what we're doing, and then to get feedback on whether it actually works and then how it plays within the current state of debates over the issues that I outlined at the beginning. So I was in Nepal in October and India in November to organize workshops along these lines. And I'd like to tell you in the remaining time a bit about what happened and what people thought. Some of it was very much expected for me based on the dynamics I was already aware of. For instance, the author of that passage that I read to you came to the event in Kathmandu and stood up and made a kind of forceful speech very much along those lines about the need to textualize and the problems with Guru's performance. But there were also aspects of it that were somewhat unexpected to me. And I think what I was most gratified by was that people in both contexts actually took the process of workshopping the material very seriously. And of course, there were limitations to what we could do. I only had time to do one event in each community. And so in Nepal, and we invited people from all over the Thangmi region, from various villages, to come together. We had about 50 people. Did I not have the whole event? Sorry. Well, this shows you one view of it. We had about 50 people from different parts of the Thangmi community in Nepal. In India, it was in Darjeeling, so in the central bazaar, and we didn't do so well at attracting people from all over the region for various logistical reasons, but we actually had about 150 people there, so it was quite well attended. And in both situations, we had a full day for the event, but still, of course, how much can people actually read and comment on a detailed piece of oral literature, so to speak, within a short time frame. But the way that we set it up was to give them an overview, a presentation of the whole project in which we ran through what I've just showed you here. So these materials, showing them what the text looked like and talking about the considerations that we had gone through in preparing it. So we did that as just like this, an overhead projection. And then we distributed printed materials to small working groups. We tried to get people to break into groups of four or five, representing different factions within the Tangmi community and also different regional areas, because different dialects are spoken and there are different emphases in ritual practice as well. So here you see one of the working groups in Kathmandu, which includes one of the senior gurus from Dolaka on the far right-hand side, a guru from Sindhupalchok district in the middle, and then two young activists who are the ones writing, as you might expect, towards the left-hand side, and a woman from Dolaka as well. And we tried to also include as many women as possible, which was something of a challenge, but it was interesting to me to see that they actually did talk relatively openly in the Kathmandu event as well. So they had a period of time in which to look at a sample from the ritual text, and we gave each group a different section to look at. They had a few pages, and they were able to go through it, discuss it, and then write comments. So this just shows you some of that in process. And there were very animated discussions going on all across the room. Again, this is about 50 people in total, so about 10 groups of five each. And one of the interesting things was that in the Nepal context, this model of a workshop was immediately understood, which I think comes out of the development context and the fact that many people have been exposed to development trainings over time. They understood the concept of sitting together, breaking into a group, discussing, coming back, presenting to the larger group. And I was really impressed with that. This was not the case in Darjeeling at all, which I hadn't really anticipated. And there it was very difficult to actually get people to understand the type of process that we were asking them to engage in. And I think that has to do with the lack of development initiatives there and people not being familiar with that kind of model, but also the type of political forum that people are most used to being in which it's much more formalized. There's somebody talking at the front to people who are sitting and listening. And the notion of a kind of collaborative process was difficult to explain, but we did get somewhere with it in the end. So I just wanted to show you a few of the comments that we received and tell you what some of the major issues that people had were. One of them, and this came up especially in Nepal, was that people were very concerned that there were many Nepali loan words in what was supposed to be the Tangmi, original Tangmi ritual recitations. So here you see that in red, people have circled words which should not actually be in Nepali, words where there are known Tangmi words, yet the guru actually recited them in Nepali. And this led to quite a lot of debate where people said to me, obviously you need to do more research because you haven't yet located the pure Tangmi recitation in Palokkayan practice. The way I tried to deal with that and what we discussed was whether, in fact, there was an ideal form which could be located and whether it was a matter of simply having not found it or whether, in fact, as people eventually reflected and admitted, in most practice contexts, there is this appropriation of a large percentage of Nepali words. And I think people began to understand that what we were trying to do was to represent it as we recorded it, not, again, to construct an ideal type. But there were certain people who were not happy with that formulation and made that known. And so one of the things we need to think about as we move forward with this project is exactly how to deal with that if we're just going to explain it in the introduction, if we're going to footnote the specific words and offer Tangmi words when we know that they are, that they do exist, in order to kind of create a balance. So somebody wrote in English as well, I think need more research about language, and that was getting to the same sort of issue. The other thing was this a concern about authenticity in general. Is this the real thing? And again, this notion that simply producing a ritual text based on one guru's recitation was not adequate, but many people wanted to see more of the kind of ideal type. we explained why it was we felt we couldn't do that, that that wasn't, in fact, our role as scholars. It was our role to represent what we found, but that we hoped that this might be a basis for community groups themselves, in fact, to produce what they might want to see in the future. So that's how we went forward with that one. Just to finish up here, this gives you a view of the program in Darjeeling. Sorry that that photo is a little bit washed out. And I just wanted to conclude by talking a bit about the other aspect of the workshops that, and programs that we organized, which was to show video clips based on the last 10 years of research with various members of the Tangmi community. So what we were trying to do was to show some of these ritual recitations in practice and to find a way to move beyond purely the notion of textualization, but to use the term that in particular the Tangmi community in Darjeeling uses to talk about videoization. And this is something that they've actually been engaged in within their own community for several years now, trying to actually document in video cultural practice in process, and we've also engaged in it. And so in addition to workshopping the ritual text, we also showed about an hour of video clips, which had been edited into a rough kind of structure focused around different ritual events. And this was something that actually played quite an important role, both in field work as a whole, but also within the particular workshops in terms of creating a context in which people who were not literate, which still describes many members of the Tangmi community, could also engage with the process of discussion about cultural practice and performance and authenticity. And also, it became clear that in terms of kind of bridging this impasse between gurus and activists, that video can be an important tool, along with radio and other forms of non-textual forms of objectification or forms of representation, for lack of better terms. Because from a guru's perspective, there's still an element of control that they maintain over a video recording. They're still the ones performing, and it's their performance, their recitations that are being captured. Yet from an activist perspective, video or audio recordings can actually be circulated within broader public domains. And so it seems that this might be a strategy to pursue and that community members themselves are interested in pursuing in the future in terms of finding a way to preserve cultural materials that doesn't limit them only to text and actually achieve some of the agendas or reaches a kind of compromise solution. So, coming to a close, I just want to suggest that we talk a little bit more about what the anthropologist's role is in all of this. I've come to see my role as one that has to do with production of all of these materials in several senses. Obviously, there's the literary production of a text. There's also the sense of being a producer in the aesthetic sense of film or theater, for instance, of creating these kinds of contexts in which diverse individuals come together, express ideas, move forward with something, creating that pragmatic context. And ultimately, and perhaps the most uncomfortable way of thinking about it, is actually being a part of the process of cultural production oneself. And I think ultimately that is what has happened and is often what happens in these kind of contexts, because what results from our project both in terms of the ritual text and in terms of perhaps a documentary film, which is one of the things that the community members really would like to see, is a kind of representation of culture, which has been produced through our engagement as anthropologists with the community over time, and that's quite different from what they might have produced on their own. I'm quite curious to see how this all plays out, and the text project is ongoing, and I'll be going back, hopefully, next year to continue the process of discussion with the community and see where we can get. Thank you. Thank you.